Hello and welcome to this week's Standing With Refugees podcast, and thank you for joining us. I'm Paul Hutchings, one of the founders of Refugee Support, and this week I am talking to Krista Hobart. Thank you very much for joining us, Krista, and the reason that we're talking is that you're involved with supporting refugees, but you also joined us on our walk from the north of Greece into Macedonia last month.
It was the best. I'm so glad that I happened across it and that I said yes to doing it. It was the best thing ever. I mean, I couldn't have been happier with the people and the whole experience and just an amazing time. So thank you.
I mean, it was lovely to have you along, and I mean, it was lovely to have everyone along. And I think that was the thing that really, I got the most out of, and was the best thing was just 20 people all walking together. Just having great conversations for the whole week.
Well, the best part by far was the people. And I knew that going into it, that the best part would be the people. Of course, the scenery was beautiful, and the intent of the walk, kind of keeping in mind that the refugees had done a similar thing and that we were walking in their footsteps, was very meaningful and powerful, but definitely the people and the conversations. And the best part about the conversations was that they were disjointed and they didn't really flow, because you would be walking along for hours at a time and you'd start talking to somebody and then maybe we'd stop and look at a bug or a flower or something. And then your walking partner would change because you'd pick up with somebody else. And so it felt like conversations never started and they never finished. They just kind of flowed like the wind. It was just, I loved the conversations was the best part about it.
Yes, I mean, I think we talked a bit about, some family stuff, which was pretty deep, mm-hmm. and that was great. And I think I shared the secrets to a happy relationship as well, didn't I?
Yes, you did. And I got a good kick out of those. And the best thing that we shared, though, was the regrets in life. What the hospice worker had kind of said, what she had found out over her years as being a hospice nurse. What people's regrets in life were. And I found it so fascinating that within seconds, we're in the middle of nowhere, probably in Macedonia, you pulled it up on your phone and we could instantly refer to exactly what those 5 or 10 points were that people regretted in life. And so that was my favorite conversation, actually, Paul, of the entire trip.
And if anyone's interested in that, I mean, it is easy to find on the internet and some of you may well have already seen it. What did you think about some of the places we went where the refugees had passed through?
I think the most impactful was Idomeni. I've always been very curious about that since I've kind of been involved with doing refugee aid work for a little over two and a half years now. Idomeni is kind of the one place people always talk about, and I hadn't been there and had seen all the photos, so I was very curious to see that, and that was the first thing that we did. And you spoke that morning at the little coffee shop there, and just imagining what that would have been like a few years ago with all those people in that tiny little town and all that drama kind of unfolding right there in people's farms and backyards and in their coffee shops and their little spot. It was just so, you could picture it, but at the same time, hard to imagine what it must have been like for the people that not only live there, but of course the refugees who are going through this pretty traumatic thing, and the weather being so terrible, and it was delightful for us, but it was terrible when the refugees were there and the borders were closed and there was all the water and it was cold. And I really found that was an impactful place. And I also loved walking along the train tracks and having lunch at the train station. And you could just picture what the refugees would have gone through and what that would have been like. I mean, we were there during the day and it was nice weather. I'm sure a lot of refugees were walking at night and it was scary and they were walking to a place that of unknown, whereas we knew exactly where we were going and that we had lunch and water and people didn't know where their next meal was going to be. So those are the two places that stick out for me as the most kind of impactful, because I could picture exactly what the refugees would have been doing in that same spot.
I mean, I think I'll always remember the train tracks and walking alongside there. Because there were things like, there was a shoe here and there, or, there was bits of litter, or there was where the camp was, and then we stopped at the train station and there was graffiti on the wall, and then there was a notice from the UNHCR saying, you know, don't walk on the train tracks because people have died, being hit by trains, walking along that, making that journey along there, and it felt like, it had quite a ghost-like quality for me.
Yeah, and you know it's funny you mentioned the shoes. Like I thought of shoes the whole time. I mean, shoes and feet just kept on running through my head the whole time we were on that trip because there were random shoes all over the place. Like you would just look down and there would be a shoe or a shoelace or a sole of a shoe, and just kind of wondered the story behind what is that? You know, why is that one shoe there, or the one sole, and did the person have to continue their walk without the rubber on the bottom of their shoe? Is that why the piece of shoe was there? And there were remnants of refugee stuff, yeah, all over. I know I saw, I'm sure you did too, we walked by something and there's a UNH, one of the wool blankets that you see all over the place was in the field. I so much wanted to grab that blanket, but it was supposed to be laying there for a reason. So there it stayed. But I would have liked a piece of that.
Yes, I mean, I saw that. I mean, I think that was on, I think on our first day when we walked away
Yeah.
from the Echo petrol station,
Yeah.
gas station there. And I mean, that was particularly weird for me because the last time I'd been to that gas station, there were a couple of thousand people, you know, camped out around
Yeah.
there. It was, I mean, it was a crazy, crazy, mad place. And then we were the only people there. I mean, I think one car came in to fill up. It was
I
weird.
know. It was weird. And again, it's like a sunny day. And that's again one of those kind of iconic places that you saw in images all over the internet and whatever was that Echo Station and all the people there in the tents and the mayhem. And then when we're there, it's just a gas station where we went in and bought some snacks and we paid €1 to use the bathroom. I mean, just such an opposite of how it must have been 2 years ago, you know? But such an honor to be there because you could really, I think for those of us that went on the hike, we knew exactly what that petrol station was. You know, we knew what had happened there and what the significance of it was. I'm not sure the other cars that were just getting gas that day knew what happened there 2 years ago, but it was kind of like a haunting. Yeah, I guess like you said, a ghost feeling. Like this is a haunting feeling was kind of always there, but somehow it was like oddly comforting. I don't know why. Maybe just the company that we were with.
Yes, I mean, again, we've said this already, but I mean, the guys that we were walking with, I mean, what a lovely, lovely bunch of people. And I mean, I've got a little video that I took on our last evening when we were all having dinner together. And you know, it's a video of just of people eating, but it's got this really lively kind of chat noise going on. We can hear you, of course.
Of course, yeah. I usually stand out in a crowd.
But everyone's chatting to each other, and I just thought, oh, this is, you know, what a lovely thing to have done, and as well to have recognised, you know, that you know we had 5 days of walking, and you know, some, you know, towards the end of the day, it was pretty tiring. It was as nothing compared to what some of those people had to do, and, you know, because not only did they have to walk that much further with all the kind of, you know, hardships, but they didn't know where they were going to be sleeping that night. They didn't know where they were going. You know, they were wondering about friends and family that they'd lost. I mean, it was a real mix of emotions for me the whole week.
Yeah, I mean the same thing for me too. I really just felt like, not that the refugees were walking alongside us at all, but that I really understood what they went through, even though ours was definitely much more comfortable and everything. It really gave you a sense of what they must have gone through, and again, kind of what they were thinking along the way. Like we had a van that were the bus that would be there at the end with food, and if someone had gotten injured or tired, we could have made our way to that. Whereas the refugees would not have had anything nearly as luxurious and simple things like bug spray. I mean, we had bug spray. No one would have, a refugee wouldn't have used their precious little backpack of little limited space that they had to throw along some bug spray. I mean, that's just not what you're thinking about, you know? Yeah, I mean, the walk was just fantastic. You know, I didn't mention the seat before, but after I finished the hike, I went. And on and met some other refugees and some other aid work that I was doing, and I told one of them what I had done, and I was kind of nervous to tell them about this hike that we had gone on because it seemed that I was kind of preaching to the choir, and I told him about the walk, and while he thought it was neat that we did it, he did kind of chuckle and said, "Well, you should do it at night when there's dogs," is what he said, because he had made it from Afghanistan to Greece to Norway for 2 years, and then was sent back to Afghanistan. And then I met him again 3 weeks ago. He was in Greece again trying to do the route again. So he had actually walked to Greece twice. So he knew well what I was talking about, and I just thought it was so funny. Well, you should be there in the dark when there's dogs. We did not experience the dogs on our hike.
We didn't, and nor did we experience the night. And I mean that story is something that I just find, it's one of the things that really frustrates me about our whole attitude to refugees. They are, I mean, something like that guy. I mean, how resourceful and resilient must he be to have made that journey and to have done it again?
Right,
And
and he's 19.
I mean,
19.
why wouldn't we just roll out the red carpet to people like that?
I don't know, and he speaks seven languages.
Yeah,
I mean,
that's
he's the most amazing kid. And yeah, I mean, we've all, all of us who have done refugee work have heard crazy stories, of how people got to where they are. But there were two that I heard this last time that were the craziest, and his might win the, he's done it twice, so he knew exactly what to do the second time.
yeah.
Crazy.
Well, it's what extraordinary, extraordinary. And you mentioned there other aid work.
Yeah.
You went on to Chios after the walk, is that right?
Yes, I did. I needed a day to recover in Thessaloniki, and then after and get some sleep, and then I went on to Chios, which is an island I had been to before, ironically, 10 years ago on a cruise. So I did a Mediterranean cruise 10 years ago and stopped on Chios, and then to be there, 10 years later to do refugee aid work, it couldn't have been a more opposite experience. But yeah, Chios was something else because that's kind of, like Lesbos, what considered the front lines of the refugee crisis when folks are coming over from Turkey. They either go to Lesbos or Chios is pretty much where they go. And that's where I spent 6 days doing aid work after the hike, and I really enjoyed it. It was great. I mean, the people there are the refugees again. It's the craziest stories, and most of them had just, were more new arrivals, not like on the mainland where people have kind of been around for a while, so they maybe emotions aren't as so fresh, or they're not exactly sure what's in store. So maybe they're more, I don't want to say excited, hopeful. When they're there, and whereas folks I think on the mainland that have been stuck there for a couple of years, there's just a different mindset.
And what are the conditions like for the people on Chios now?
Well, there used to be a camp right in the main town called Camp Souda, and that is no longer there, but I saw exactly where it is, and it was right in the town, which would have been convenient for refugees. They could have gotten to services and felt like they're part of the community. But the camp has been moved, and I don't know how long it's been at Camp Vial, which is about, it takes an hour and a half to walk there from the. So if you're at Camp Vial and you want to walk to town, it takes an hour and a half. And the camp is at, going up a mountain. So I can't imagine what it will be like in the heat of the summer now for people if they want to come and go into town. I mean, there is a bus that you can take. It's my belief that you need to sign up for it a day beforehand. You can't just decide you want to take the bus back and forth to town. I think you need a ticket for it, and you need to sign up the day before. But just walking back and forth to camp, I mean, it's so remote and so disconnected from the town, and there's nothing for people to do up there. I think there's 1,800 people at that camp. So just in terms of being an outsider. I mean, you're already an outsider when you're a refugee. You're trying to fit in, and you look different from the people that are the main people living in the town. And then to be put in this place that's an hour and a half to walk from, it's just not right. I mean, there's nothing right about a refugee camp to begin with, but this one is just, it's so far away and so remote and just so disconnected to real life. And then you meet the people in the camp, and they're no different than people at every camp. They're the most interesting, fascinating people with great things to contribute to our world, and then they're stuck in this place. It's just not right. But we all know that who have done this work. The whole situation is just not right, and you just do what you can do to make it a little bit better for somebody. And if it's that you give somebody a hug that day, or you say something positive, or you smile, then you got to feel good about yourself that you did something good that day.
It's a crazy, crazy world and a crazy policy to keep people on those islands for as long as they do in the conditions that they do. What do you think people need there? I mean, apart from being allowed to move off the islands.
Well, they have needs just like everybody else. There are several small NGOs that are working there, and they're doing the best job that they can do. Again, I was only there for 6 days, but it seems like everyone's doing a good job of working together and getting them the supplies and the things that they need. But there's just so many people there, and I still am baffled at how unorganized the crisis is. I mean, this is not new. This has been going on for years. Why there's not more services, and why it's not more organized, and why there's not more, I mean, maybe this is, I don't know if this is good or bad to say, government involved. I mean, there's regular people like me. I'm a mom from Buffalo, New York. Like, I don't have a special skill. I'm not a social worker. I'm not a doctor. I'm just like a regular person, and I'm over there doing this work. It's just kind of it's just baffling, but I guess it does prove that one person can make a difference. I guess that's the silver lining in it. If you want to make a difference and you want to go and help and you don't have a special skill like a doctor or a nurse, you can. But to the degree that it's not organized in a better, more global way with more of the world helping is still just unbelievable to me.
Yeah, it's baffling. Yeah, I mean, anyone can help. It's I mean, what I say to all the volunteers, you just need to have a ready smile and a willingness to get involved with whatever needs to be done, and just come with some enthusiasm.
Yeah, and you can't have a plan. That's the biggest thing. If you're somebody who wants to be organized and have a plan, you got to switch your mindset to be someone who wants to go with the flow. Because the best laid out plan doesn't really apply in this situation.
And before you joined the walk, you were in Athens as well, helping there, is that right?
Yeah, I just did a little bit of help on the front end this time. We just went to the Hope Cafe and helped them stock up on supplies, but I've helped them in the past. This was actually my fifth aid trip in the last less than 2 years. So I've done a few things. I love helping in Athens. I love the city of Athens, and I think how I got started in doing the aid work is maybe a little unusual too. I have a very, very deep-seated love for the country of Greece that I've had since I was a kid. And when the refugee crisis started, I was drawn to it a lot. A, because of it wasn't right, but B, because of the place that it was taking place. I mean, this is a country and a people who are amazing and have such a resilience in life and have been refugees themselves before, and just a deep-seated love that I have for the country and the people. I mean, Greece is doing an amazing job given the situation of taking care of people when they themselves have their own issues and financial struggles going on. I think that if they picked a good, they've got a good place that they're going to. The Greeks are just the most amazing people and willing to help in any way that they can, even with their own limited resources. And the rest of the world should follow by example.
You said that you got involved because you've got that affinity for Greece, that love for Greece that goes back a long way. But what was it that took the mum from Buffalo to Greece to help?
The same image that so many people saw, Aylan Kurdi on the beach. I mean, that could have been my son. I have a son who's 15 now, but when I saw that photo, I mean, that could have been my child, and how is this happening? How is this happening? And people weren't taking notice. It just was so baffling to me that this could be happening in a place that, for myself, that I only ever knew like love and this wonderful place. And how could this tragedy be unfolding? And how is the world not in a complete uproar and doing something about it? So that's when, for me, I said, oh, I can't sit here and watch this happen. I mean, it's not possible to watch it on the internet. I need to go and do something to make a tangible difference and to believe that it was even happening. It kind of needed to see it. Kind of like when we were in Idomeni, I think so many of us needed to see that place because of what happened there, and that it was so unbelievable that you just needed to see it to believe that it was really true.
What did you do with that first trip to Greece? How did you get involved?
I went on the first trip with a group called Carry the Future, and they're fantastic. And
Yeah, big
they,
supporters of ours, actually. Really great.
yeah, they're a great group of people. And they started out by handing out baby carriers in the port in Piraeus. That's kind of how they got their start. So I went on my first trip with them, and when I went, it was right when the borders had just closed. So we didn't do a lot of handing out of the baby carriers because people were starting to get trapped. In Greece. But that's how I started out. And then I moved over to Allied Aid, and I can't honestly tell you why I kind of moved over there. I think it was timing of a trip. I knew that it was time to go on another one, and it wasn't going to work out to go with Carry the Future. So I went with another group called Allied Aid, and then I've done four subsequent trips with them. And now I'm their distribution trip volunteer coordinator. So I get other people excited about going and helping out the people and being able to help. I mean, I think if you're a doctor or a nurse or a teacher or something like that, where you help people every day in your job, you get that sort of fulfillment of like, gosh, I made a difference today. In my job, I love my job, but it's not that same kind of fulfilling feeling. And doing this refugee work really makes me feel like that I'm contributing to the world and in a making a difference in a positive way and in a way that works for me, that I'm getting as much out of it as I feel like I get more out of it than I give, actually. And I think a lot of us volunteers would say the same thing, that just being there and helping, we get so much out of the what we're doing as well.
Yes, I mean, I have this conversation with volunteers quite a lot about enjoyment and getting a lot out of it themselves. And volunteering, giving your time in as much as possible, a selfless way to help other people. I don't know, you get back more than you give, I think.
I totally agree. I mean, it is kind of you do feel kind of funny about it sometimes. Like I love going so much that yeah, you think, am I going for the wrong reason? But I'm not. I'm not going for the wrong reason. I'm going to help. I mean, it's funny. I just came from a doctor appointment, and the doctor asked me, "Oh, how was your trip?" And I said, "Oh, it was great. This is my fifth aid trip I've done. I loved it." And he asked me how the food was. And I looked at him and I said, well, it wasn't really about the food. But it is funny. People ask you those kinds of questions, and I'm not even thinking about the food. I'm thinking about helping people and talking to people. I mean, I think that for me, and each person has their thing that they're good at, like, when I go, I wear my heart on my sleeve, and I feel like my heart is ripped open and raw, wide open the whole time. And I don't know if that's good or bad because I come home and I'm usually traumatized, but I would have it no other way. Like, I love to go and feel all the raw emotions and meet all the people and hear their stories, as horrific as they might be, and try to put myself in their shoes and try to help them have like a normal day or a normal conversation with somebody.
We get approached a lot by people who say that they want to do stuff for the kids, the babies, and the mothers, and because they're vulnerable groups, and it's perfectly understandable. But actually, the young men, I keep on saying, yes, the women and the kids are vulnerable, but they do get quite a lot of extra support because of that. Those young guys, they carry huge responsibilities around. They're not great at looking after themselves. They get into all kinds of scrapes with with the other young men. They're the ones who are actually cutting themselves and trying to kill themselves. It can get quite, it gets, they're having a hard time.
And I will say that on this, when I was just in Chios, I noticed that more than any other time. And I don't know if it's just that I happened to be around this group of young guys that I kind of ended up following a couple of them to Athens and know what's kind of going on with these guys. But there are so many mental health issues, and these young guys are the forgotten group, in my opinion, because yes, there are diapers for the babies and there's things for moms and there's arts and there are different things. But for this group of teenage boys and young men, it seems like there isn't a lot other than, and I could be wrong, but on Chios, I felt like the only thing I could see for young men was language classes. There just didn't seem like there was a lot of other things for them to do. and they've got so much to offer to the world, and so smart and resourceful. They will, you know, they're very resourceful and figuring out how to get what they need to get where they're going to get the next step. And I love them. I mean, I had one heartbreaking story on this trip, and there was a young man that I will never forget who, and it was a conversation I had to cut myself off from too, because it was too heavy for me. But he and I sat on a park bench with Google Translate on our phones, and he had been cutting himself. I could see it on his arm. I saw that on many people this time. And he had fresh marks, and he was telling me about them through his Google Translate. And I'm just thinking the whole time, oh my gosh, mom from Buffalo, New York, like, this is out of my skill set of topics to talk about. Like, I don't know how to advise this kid what to do or anything, let alone in English, let alone through Google Translate, which is probably going to screw up the message. But I just thought, all right, I'm just going to be like I would be with my kid. And I put my arm around him, and we talked, and he put his head on, I don't know how old this kid is, 19, 21, something like that. He was very tall, put his head on my shoulder and just kind of nestled into my shoulder. And we continued to have this conversation about how he wanted to kill himself and all these things. And it was very, very difficult for me because I didn't know what to do. And then I was finished the conversation. We became Facebook friends. And then a couple days later, he sent me a picture of himself in the hospital hooked up to all these machines because he had tried to kill himself, and I didn't know what to do with that. So that, you know, those kinds of things happen, and those kinds of things are real. And if you open yourself up to the 19-year-old kid putting your head on your shoulder, telling you this story, I guess you need to be prepared for the rest of it, which was difficult. That was very difficult for me this time. So, but it's very real. I mean, the amount of kids cutting themselves, it's staggering, and I don't know what the fix is for that, other than to give these kids love and something to do, and you're not have something to do in a camp on the top of a mountain in the middle of nowhere on an isolated island. I mean, it's just not happening there.
Yeah, well, the answer, of course, is to you know, give people a bit of you know, stability in their lives, and say, here's where you're going to be for the next few years, and here's the job that you're able to have, and here's somewhere to live, and, you know, here's a community that will support you.
Yeah.
We're clearly not doing that by keeping them in inhumane conditions, in some kind of limbo, while they wait forever for asylum applications to get processed.
Yeah. The one thing that was interesting on HEOS too was two of the aid organizations I worked with. One is called FEOX. They had there were several refugees that helped that were helping in their warehouse, so that was cool. You know, there are people that came every day to help in the warehouse, and that gave them something to do. They would take the bus all the way into town and then help for the day, and then head back up to camp. And there, I also worked with another group just for a short time called the HEOS People's Kitchen, which I really liked. They provide food to a couple of different several different organizations on the island, and they too had some refugees that were working in the kitchen. One particularly funny man that I had a great time with delivering the food with. We were deciding whether we would listen to Turkish music or Greek dance music on the radio as we were delivering the food that day. But he was a refugee there with his wife and family in UN housing, but he seemed rather well adjusted. You know, he found his like little place and to bide time for the next little while, and that would be to be the chef at this kitchen and to help to deliver food. So there, I think that there are those, if people can find those opportunities, or aid organizations can provide those opportunities to refugees, I think that really helps. If they have a place to go every day and a community of people that they know is there for them if they need anything.
Yeah, really, really, I think you're right. And I think it's also worth saying, you know, well done to Kostas and his wife for the setting up the Kiosk People's Kitchen, and you know, how hard they've worked to try and support, you know, as local Kiosk people, trying to support refugees that have been arriving. Really great.
Yeah, it's a neat little place. One of the things that I'm most proud that I did, that one of the things that I'm really proud of, is the impact that my volunteering has done on my kids. My daughter Stella is she's 16, and I brought her with me last year And we went to work in Athens at the Hope Cafe, and then we went to do a mural project at Skaramaga. And it was just so impactful. And I'm so grateful that my daughter wanted to go in the first place. I never even asked her if she wanted to go. She just decided that it was something cool that her mom was doing, and she wanted to be a part of it. And she would like to come again this summer. So I think my family is... I've impacted my family too, so maybe I make a little bit of difference by hugging people and telling them they're great and delivering some food while they're in Greece. But it's funny, it's had a really positive impact on my family at home and my kids, and that's something I'm really proud of.
Yeah, good for you, and I mean it's great to hear that as well. I think, I mean, just generally, I know that volunteers have all got families that. Also make sacrifices so that, you know, we can do the work we do, and, you know, big love and thanks to them for that. On to something else, Krista. How's the situation in the States at the moment? I mean, we see a lot of news about it. And let's talking specifically about refugees, I suppose.
Well, we're not letting a whole lot of people in. Mm. That's sad. It's not right. Our country is built on immigrants. That's the whole reason we're here, is we're a country of immigrants, and all of us, unless you're American Indian, which, you know, I don't know a whole lot of people that are American Indian. Our relatives are from somewhere else. And so the fact that we've kind of closed our door, and particularly to countries that we, you know, that we've kind of deemed are dangerous is crazy. But unfortunately, there's not a lot of chat about it. There's not a lot of talk about it. I mean, I'm tuned into it, but if you talk to other folks, they probably aren't paying that much attention. It's sad. It's not right.
What do you think about, that's politically, but what about sort of, you know, like your circle or, you know, your community? How are they about, receiving more refugees? What do you think?
Because again, it's not really talked about. I mean, if I asked my friends, would you be supportive of it? I think the majority of them would, because A, they know what I do, and no one would dare tell me something else. but it's just not talked about. I think we know we're not, the policy right now is we're just not letting a lot of people in, and there's not much we can do about it other than to protest every once in a while when there's a protest going on about it. It just kind of unfortunately is what the situation is until we're able to change the people running our country, which we don't get to change for a little bit yet. So,
hopefully soon, right?
Hopefully soon. It can't happen fast enough, if you ask me. But yeah, it is an interesting time to live in the United States. I must say, it's an interesting time, you know, to be here. Politics are crazy, you know, and there's too much chat about it, and not enough doing something to make the country move in the right direction.
Yeah, I mean the US looks a bit crazy at the moment, but I mean it's crazy. It's crazy in the UK, and actually, yeah. Looking at Greece, Italy, you know, these places are crazy as well, and we just seem to be. I don't know. Hopefully, the pendulum will swing the other way soon.
You know what? Someone said to me on this last trip was, you know, it's the governments of the world that's, you know, it's the government that screws everything up. But the people, when you meet the people, they're fantastic. You know, I mean, why are we afraid of people from Afghanistan? I mean, are you kidding me? I just spent the most delightful, had great conversations with all these boys from and young men from Afghanistan. They're great. There's no reason to be afraid of these people from other countries. I just don't understand it. But that's me. And I've been, you know, I've dove in headfirst into this refugee thing, and I've always been one to think different isn't dangerous. So it ticks me off when people are judge people by what they've got on the outside and not what's on the inside.
Absolutely, and what a lovely sentiment to end on, Krista. It's been a real honor to spend a week with you walking, and a real honor to talk to you now. Thank you very much. And thank you for standing with refugees. Thank you to everybody for listening. We talk to someone every week, make it available to download on Monday, most Mondays, trying to do it most Mondays. You can subscribe on Podbean and iTunes. Download, find it on our website. Please tell us what you think by emailing me, paul@refugeesupport.eu. We're also on Facebook, Twitter and Instagram. If you search for us, you'll find us. And if you have any suggestions about who we can talk to, please let us know. Thank you very much.
Thank you.